This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. How do you turn a great idea into a business? And once a business gets off the ground, how do you keep it going beyond the first year? John Derry with the Center for American Entrepreneurship says one third of startups fail by their second year and half fail by their fifth year. His organization and others like the National Entrepreneur Center in Orlando want to create a better environment for startups. We are joined by John Derry. He's the founder and president of the Center for American Entrepreneurship. John, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Also with us, Jerry Ross. He is the president of the National Entrepreneur Center. Jerry, thank you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And John F. Davis. He's the executive vice president of the Orlando Regional Chamber of Commerce. John, thank you as well.
Thank you.
John Derry, I want to start with you. Give me a snapshot of what it's like to be an entrepreneur going into starting a business. What are you looking at as far as that business being there 2-3 years down the track?
What entrepreneurs need to thrive is they need a great new idea, obviously. They need the capital and the talent, the people, to pursue that idea with as few unnecessary or stupid distractions as possible. So new ideas can either come from the entrepreneur themselves. They can come from the commercialization of innovation that comes out of labs, federal labs or universities. The problems that we're hearing from entrepreneurs around the country as we do roundtables with them on a regular basis is we can't find enough people with the skills that we need. Access to capital is always a perennial challenge for entrepreneurs. And then there are things like a regulatory and tax burden, uncertainty, and complexity that get in their way, that divert their attention away from the product or service that they're trying to market, and anything that gets them to take their eye off the ball increases their chances of failing.
Red tape, essentially.
Red tape, tax complexity and uncertainty. Entrepreneurs don't have the resources to hire a compliance officer or a tax officer. They're doing it all themselves. Mm-hmm. So anything, as I say, that makes them take their eye off the ball from what they should be focused on, and that's their product and service in the marketplace, increases the chances that they'll fail. And, of course, the failure rates for startups are very high.
When you talk about not enough skills, are there certain skills that are lacking right now?
The skills that we hear are lacking most of all, and this won't surprise you, are science, technology, engineering, and math. The skills gap or the STEM skills gap. Mm-hmm. We're hearing two different dimensions to that, or possibly even three. One is our education system is just not producing enough of these people. Second, our education system, to the extent that it is producing folks with those backgrounds, folks are graduating with good broad degrees, but no, quote, day one skills. It's a phrase that we hear everywhere that we go talking to entrepreneurs. And so this raises the issues of apprenticeships, of work study programs, the kind of combination of academic work and experience that you see in Northern Europe, and particularly in Germany. We hear all the time the American education system needs to be more like Germany. Mm-hmm. The other aspect of this is that, we don't have enough folks here domestically, and we can't augment the gap with foreign-born talent because our immigration policies are insane. Hmm. So it's a double whammy of not enough folks domestically and not having immigration policies that help us attract and retain the best talent.
Jerry Ross, president of the National Entrepreneur Center, talk if you could about some of those barriers. I mean, for a start, some of them are kind of big barriers that are things that can only really be fixed at the federal level, right? Like the immigration system, getting talent from overseas. I mean, that's a pretty big barrier to overcome.
That's right, and that's at the federal level. Many people that we see at the National Entrepreneur Center are local businesses that may have a great idea, but may just know about that small segment of what they do. They need help in other areas like business plans and cash flow analysis and the things that are required to run a business. And so just having a good idea isn't good enough. Mm-hmm. And so what we've been successful as a community is bringing together all of those resources that have a single mission, and that's to help our small business community, and put it all in one place that someone can come and they can get help in marketing or in business planning or in strategic planning, whether they're just starting or whether they're even looking to say, now I'm ready to do international trade.
Mm-hmm. What about those ideas too? Are entrepreneurs kind of collegial, or do they keep some of their ideas pretty close to their chest? Because if you have a good idea, sometimes you might not necessarily want to let your entrepreneurial competitors know about it, right?
Well, there is a piece of intellectual property that you do want to protect. But what we find is the entrepreneurial community, especially here in Orlando, is very collegial. I've never met an entrepreneur that didn't say, I'll help. And so having them all in one place also provides a common bond of we're all pursuing our ideas together. Mm-hmm. And so lots of folks will say, I can help you because I've been there. I've been through that issue. I've been through that challenge myself. And so as an entrepreneur myself, there are times that people walk in the front door and I've seen that look in the mirror that we know what you're going through and we know how to help.
What are some of the businesses that you've started?
Well, that's a whole range. From the folks currently are looking at things like drones, mm-hmm. Flying drones through a citrus grove and can tell you how many oranges are on the trees. We have folks that are doing heavy lift drones for the military. But all the way down to folks that run a pedicab company that has about 40 or 50 independent contractors that drive pedicabs over the weekend. So it's a whole range of businesses from I've got an idea to let's trade with the world.
So it doesn't have to be high tech.
No, it doesn't have to be. Mm-hmm. But we do have a lot of folks that may know a lot about lasers, but not a lot about cash flow.
Mm-hmm. John Davis, where does the Chamber of Commerce come in then? What help can an organization like yours provide to local business people or people who want to get started in a business and are not sure how to do it?
Chambers pretty much serve as a hub for these businesses. The work that we do is long term of making sure that there is a sounding board, an organization in which they could also engage with like-minded businesses that perhaps maybe are further along in the success that they've been able to have in their startups. So you're talking startups to mid-tier businesses as well as large corporations that are involved with chambers. When you think about the Orlando region of Chamber of Commerce, has been around for 105 years mm-hmm. and playing a role in making sure that we provide those things that are important to these businesses and understanding our community. We're dealing with access to capital. We're dealing with contract opportunities. We're dealing with the advocacy work in which we do, as well as making sure that these businesses have the proper training and the development that they need to be able to sustain their growth potential and opportunity. So that chamber serves as that hub, and we're also working not just with the businesses, but also with the community partners as well. Mm-hmm. So it's our role and responsibility to make sure that we're the voice of the business community here in Central Florida.
Listening to some of the barriers that John Deary is talking about, like training, access to capital, let's talk about training for a start. I mean, what's your sense, John Davis, of the level of training there is here and what needs to happen to make sure that there is the talent pool here in Central Florida to sustain some of these businesses?
I think everything fits together like a puzzle. It is important. I mean, government at all levels can play a very significant role on helping to shape what the business community is going to look like, whether you're dealing with various regulations or legislation that's impactful. It's also important to make sure that there's collaboration and partnerships in which the not just our chamber, but many other organizations in which partner with entities like the National Entrepreneur Center, most recently in working with Tim Giuliani in the partnership, we've created what we call a Chamber Alliance, mm-hmm. in which we're bringing all chambers within the 7-county region together to be able to talk about things in which that may be challenges for them and or various initiatives that they may be working on, as well as making sure that they that they totally understand that the partnership is there and the resources we have to be able to help them as well.
And what about competition? Because, you know, sometimes these different regions are trying to poach businesses from each other. So how does that collaboration work?
It's our responsibility to make sure that we separate ourselves. And one of the ways in which the partnership in the Orlando Regional Chamber continues to separate itself is to be forward thinking, mm-hmm. to look towards the future, to make sure that we're at least providing what we consider to be the basic DNA of what a chamber should do. And then also we're looking forward towards the future. As to we're talking about STEM, as John mentioned, and many other things, mm-hmm. To make sure that we're on the cutting edge. Today, we're going to live in today's world, but where are we going? You have augmentation. You have all sorts of things that are happening and taking place. And it's our responsibility to look to the future and to figure out what is this community going to look like in 10 years, 20 mm-hmm. years, 30 years from now.
How much of what the Chamber of Commerce does or focuses on is now startups as opposed to businesses that have been around for decades?
We're open door. We are an open door to all businesses. It's our responsibility, whether it's a startup or a mid-tier business or a large business, to work with them. And if there is, and also it's important for us to work with other chambers, as I mentioned earlier, to figure out what that fit might be for a smaller business in which we will work with the NEC and to have to partner with them, to partner with the Small Business Administration and other entities to do what we call a business boot camp or something of that nature in which we have panel discussions to be able to make sure that we're listening to our members, understand what they need, and then providing them with the resources and the workshops and seminars for them to be successful.
John Derry, if I could come back to you, what's the success rate for startups? Like, how many startups you might go back to that the person who started that business and 2 or 3 years later they're not doing that business or they've gotten out of it completely?
Entrepreneurship, by its very nature, is experimental. And many entrepreneurs are serial entrepreneurs. They may start a business and fail, start another and fail, or they may tweak the business model, the original one, and start, you know, go in a different direction. The basic statistics on startups is a third fail by their second year, half fail by their fifth. So very high failure rate, but it's an incredibly important part of our economy. There has been a lot of research in recent years that has shown that startups account for virtually all net new job creation. In fact, a study done by the University of Maryland and the Census Bureau in 2009 looked at the period between 1977 and 2005 and found that in every single year over that 30-year period, businesses younger than 5 years accounted for 100% of net new job creation, and businesses older than 5 years old in aggregate shed about 1 million jobs a year. As they incorporate capitals, they get better at what they do as they focus on what they're good at. So another way of saying that is, without new and young firms launching and creating jobs, the jobs base in this country would shrink by about 1 million jobs a year. In addition, startups are also disproportionately responsible for the innovations, especially big innovations or transformational, radical, or disruptive innovations, the way it's commonly referred to. And the reason why that's important is, as we know from the great work of Robert Solow, who won the Nobel Prize for this insight in 1987, is that innovation is the driving force of economic growth. So you've got this very interesting sort of two sides of the same coin, Jekyll and Hyde aspect of startups, that they're very fragile and a large portion of them fail within 5 years, and yet they're enormously important to the vitality of the economy.
Are there parts of the country that have the kind of environment where entrepreneurs are going to do better than elsewhere? Is there kind of a place
a recipe?
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of talk. Of course, Silicon Valley is one of the great entrepreneurial and innovative centers on the planet. And there's always a conversation that's going on, you know, both here in the United States and other countries. How do we, can we reproduce and replicate Silicon Valley somewhere else?
Right.
What are the necessary elements? And there, I mean, it's a very hard question to answer. There's a lot of exciting things that are going on all over the country. There are our cities around the country: New York, Austin, Chicago, Boulder, Colorado, Orlando, Florida. Where there's a tremendous amount of entrepreneurial activity going on. However, in aggregate, if you look at the country as a whole, rates of entrepreneurship are actually at 3- and 4-decade lows.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of work that we need to do on, I would argue, in my organization, the Center for American Entrepreneurship was organized to do this, to work with policymakers to clear the obstacles and barriers to entrepreneurship and try to turn that aggregate decline in entrepreneurship around.
And you think those kind of policy barriers are what is putting the lid on entrepreneurship right now?
Well, that's the purpose of the roundtables that we conduct. We do 8 or 10 a year. We get out of Washington, travel the country, and go talk to entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
We did one at the National Entrepreneur Center with Jerry in January. We've been to Memphis, Boulder. We were going to Greenville, South Carolina in 2 weeks. We've been to Seattle. And we do these, as I said, about 8 to 10 a year. And the reason is to make sure that we're staying in touch with the issues and the obstacles and the barriers that really matter to entrepreneurs, not just what we think matter. That's a very easy trap to fall in when you live in work in Washington.
What about the age of entrepreneurs? Is it getting younger? Are they getting younger?
No. As a matter of fact, the evidence is really, very interestingly, is precisely the opposite. Everybody tends to think of entrepreneurship as a young person's or millennial thing. As a matter of fact, the rates of entrepreneurship among millennials is falling to historic lows in recent years. And the age group that it has the highest rates of entrepreneurship right now are between 35 and 50. So a mid-career or mid-life is a very, very active demographic for entrepreneurship. And yet millennials are sort of, you know, dropping off. And that's very concerning for the future.
Jerry Ross, I saw you nodding your head talking about some of the places that are good for entrepreneurs, and you're saying that Orlando is a good place incubate businesses. Why is that?
Well, first of all, we have the University of Central Florida, which is very strong in research and commercialization. They have about, I think it's 8 incubators throughout the area, reaching out to research companies, tech companies, to help them grow. But we also have this collaborative community that says we want to support entrepreneurship. And 15 years ago, they started an entrepreneurship center. So I say we were doing entrepreneurship before it was cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the last 2 years, we've been rated as the top job producer in the country. That's not an accident. That's intentional. That's the community coming together to say we need to pay attention to this group of business people. Some of the regulations that have happened make it difficult to get in. Some of the companies that do get in and begin to scale are bought out by Fortune 500 companies. And that's, the new research and development department is to buy out a startup.
And is that a big issue, like the lack of money for entrepreneurs who do want to take their business on or even start it, lack of capital?
I think the startup capital is difficult because of the banking crisis. And so a lot of banks can't loan money to startups. We have Axion Microlending, which is one of the residents of the National Entrepreneur Center, that will do some microlending to companies that are just in startup mode. But I think that's...
Now, when you say microlending, what makes it a microloan? Like, how much money are you talking about?
They'll go from probably $5,000 to up to $250,000.
Okay.
But most of that is based on your credit score, not your time in business.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what makes it different. But I think that's what gave birth to crowdfunding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of the Wild West of funding, but entrepreneurs always find a way. And if they need capital, they're going to find it.
Mm-hmm.
Angel investment is another way, which is love money. You know, it comes from family and friends who love them, not necessarily their idea.
Mm-hmm.
But capital will drive innovation and will drive business startup. I think at the next stage, when they go to scale, which is where we look at creating jobs, that's when they look for venture capital.
Mm-hmm. John Davis, I want to ask about the entrepreneurial landscape and what it looks like for minority-owned businesses and women-owned businesses. And what can you tell me about that here in Central Florida?
This is definitely a place to be for minority-owned businesses as well as women-owned businesses. Doesn't matter what organization it is today, especially all chambers in various organizations are dealing with some type of program that is designed to assist women-owned businesses, which is one of the fastest growing populations of business owners in the country, especially in the minority, in which black females have led the way in black-owned businesses here in this country. We're also working with Congresswoman Murphy and her team to, we've had a women business center here before, and the partnership is working to do our part and reestablishing a women business center here in Central Florida, which is something that is very, very important.
John Derry, if I could come back to you for a moment, what would be a couple of pieces of advice you would give to an entrepreneur or somebody who's looking to start a business here in Central Florida?
Well, first of all, they ought to get in touch with the National Entrepreneur Center and make sure that they have a relationship with all of the resources there. I mean, the NEC is a remarkable resource in the sense that it's a every conceivable resource that a small or new business would need under one roof. And that's everything from business services and mentoring and coaching, office spaces, a research library, networking, you name it. Plus, there are 14 nonprofits, chambers of commerce, and government agencies there whose purpose is all designed to help new and small businesses all under one roof. So instead of sending a business person or an entrepreneur across town for something that they might need, they send them down the hall. Obviously, some kind of relationship with a university or a college is great, both from the standpoint of new ideas and talent. And then, of course, you've got to tap into some kind of a network in terms of financing, whether that is, as Jerry said, angel investors, the local venture community, crowdfunding clubs, you know, these types of things, because those are the essential things that you need to thrive. You need a great new idea or access to ideas. You need access to talent. You need access to capital. Those are the basic things that you need to get off and running, and the NEC can be a magnificent portal into all those resources.
Well, Jerry Ross, what are a couple of pieces of advice you would give to somebody looking to start a business or somebody looking to take their business to the next level if they're an entrepreneur?
Do not do it alone. That you have to surround yourself with advisors that can be formal or informal. You need to vet the idea because it's a tough road. being in entrepreneurship is risky business, and you need to manage that risk. And you can do that by getting advice, meeting with a coach, meeting with people, vetting your idea. So I think it's spending the time up front to vet the idea and make it work. And then the next thing you need to do is engage mm-hmm. with the resources that are here to help you grow a strong and profitable business.
John F. Davis, a couple of pieces of advice from you for an entrepreneur or somebody looking to take their business to the next level?
Well, definitely would advise anyone to get involved with your local chamber of commerce, first and foremost. And on personal advice would be, I always tell folks the best time to start a business is when you have a job. You know, if you have a job, that's the time in which you want to start doing your research. You want to start laying the groundwork and understand the business in which you're interested in investing, you know, time and resources in. Because, you know, there are going to be some bumps in the road, and you just want to make sure that you've done all your homework mm-hmm. before you just quit your job and decide to just go into becoming an entrepreneur.
So you want a bit of a cushion.
You definitely want that.
John F. Davis is the Executive Vice President of the Orlando Regional Chamber of Commerce. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
We're also joined by Jerry Ross. He's the President of the National Entrepreneur Center. Jerry, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And John Derry, Founder and President of the Center for American Entrepreneurship. John, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, Teaching the Incarcerated, a conversation with Dr. Pamela Karpas-Toro about Stetson University's community education project for inmates at the Tomoka Correctional Institute in Daytona Beach. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Dr. Pamela Karpas-Toro, Assistant Professor of Languages and Cultures at Stetson University, helped establish an education program for prisoners at Tomoka Correctional Institution in Daytona Beach in 2015. The Community Education Project just won a $210,000 grant from the Laughing Gull Foundation to expand its courses. From the Education Desk this week, we take a closer look at the challenge of adapting university courses for a maximum security prison. And we're joined now by Dr. Pamela Karpas-Toro. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
So this project is what, in year three now?
Yes, 3 years. We started in January 2015, mm-hmm. and we started with a migration and mobility reading group, and we started just as a reading group, and now we're going to start to offer credits in fall 2018.
What was the migration mobility reading group? What exactly did that look like and sound like, and what were you teaching them?
So it started just as a reading group, a cohort of three Stetson professors, Dr. Eisen, Dr. Petrovic, and myself. We decided to pick up a selection of literature mm-hmm. that we thought that will fit very well into the topic of migration and mobility, right? Why people move. Mm-hmm. And we established like a call for the people in the prison if they wanted to join us. And based on that call, we got a couple of candidates, and we started with around 20 students back mm-hmm. then. Mm-hmm.
Why did you pick Tomoka Correctional Institution?
We pretty much selected it because of the proximity to Stetson. It's mm-hmm. Around 25 minutes away from Stetson campus.
What was that first class like, that first reading group? Describe that moment you got in there and you introduced yourself to the folks who were taking the class. What was that experience like?
It was very interesting because if you think about the traditional classroom, this was not a traditional classroom. This was actually a visiting park. Imagine a place that there's no blackboards, there's no regular chairs like for a regular classroom. So we have to improvise a lot mm-hmm. And be very creative because it was a place just where the incarcerated people received their family members during visiting time. So we have to improvise a lot. We were sitting as a circle and try to facilitate a discussion over there. And you have to also have in mind that although Tomoka has educational programs, they're a religious based. So we were kind of like the first educational program, higher education, right? Like that was represented at that moment at mm-hmm. the prison.
So there was some adaptation you had to do to kind of make sure that your class would fit the requirements of a maximum security prison?
Yes, I previously worked at a medium security prison in mm-hmm. Illinois, Danville Correctional, but every prison is different. So yes, there's a lot of different adjustments that you have to make to every prison that you enter.
So you were coming into this with a bit of personal background, having taught in this kind of context before.
Yes.
Was this why you wanted to take a program and start it here in Central Florida?
Yes. When I was a graduate student at the University of Illinois, I was participating from Education Justice Project. It's a model in prison college that provides higher education to incarcerated individuals. So that program really was very impactful and really marked me on what was going to be my next step on the next step that I will take in mm-hmm. the higher education field. So I was a graduate student over there. So a lot of the things that I learned through under the direction of Rebecca Ginsburg, that is the director of that program, I wanted to bring a little bit of that here to Florida. Mm-hmm. Bear in mind that Florida has the third largest incarcerated population of the United States. So there's not a lot of educational programming here. And mm-hmm. I wanted to transfer a little bit of that here into Florida.
What was the response from the inmates to that first reading group? What did they enjoy it? Did they say, we want more of this? Was there a wait list to join the reading group?
I remember the first meeting that we had with students that were interested. There was a full room of incarcerated individuals. There was a lot of excitement. And yes, there was a lot of students because there was not an educational program before this. You know, students have to kind of like learn about like what is a classroom, right? Mm. Like a university classroom looks like, especially when there's no classroom, right? And we have to improvise in the visiting park. And as of today, there's a lot of people that are very interested. So as we progress our presence in the prison, there has been a lot of interest from many people that live in Tomoka, many incarcerated men over there.
Do some of them have some higher education already, or are they coming to this from a perspective of a completely new student?
So we have a mix of students. So some of them, well, all the men have a GED or high school diploma. Some of them have some either community college background, some college background, but most of them are GED students that got their GED while they were incarcerated, or they got their high school diplomas.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about what happens next, because you've now got some money to kind of extend the program. What are the next steps for this?
It's a community education project. It's we're four professors, right, that we are co-directing the project. It's Dr. Petrovic, Dr. Eisen, and Dr. Melinda Hall. And this is very important for us because it's going to allow us to provide credits to the men, because previously we were providing a very high quality education, the same that we tried to replicate the courses that we give at Stetson, but now with the difference that students will be able to earn credit. So this mm-hmm. is very, very important for us. And also with the Laughing Gull Foundation grant, we will develop more opportunities for the men to have study hall, a computer lab in the prison. So a lot of the resources that are needed, right, like for them to do research, this is going to be very, very important for us.
What's the process of trying to get those resources in place in the prison? Because it is a maximum security facility, like how many mm-hmm. hoops do you have to jump through? It's one thing having the money, but it's, I guess, yes. Then it's another to say, okay, we want to have a reading hall, we want to have computers. Is it easy to do that?
Well, actually, there's conversations, right, between the Departments of Correction and between Stetson University. So we always work with both constituencies. So as you can imagine, it's a complicated work, but both constituencies have been very helpful in this process. So mm-hmm. we're very fortunate to have both institutions align for a common goal to establish better learning opportunities for our students.
So it's a $70,000 grant a year for 3 years, right?
Mm-hmm, correct.
Does it renew at the end of that, or is this kind of the seed money that you can then see if you can keep this program going beyond that?
As of now, it's just for the 3 years, but we have seen a lot of the Laughing Gull Foundation grantees that the Laughing Gull has reestablished some sort of different connections with them, supporting different programming that they have. So we hope that not only the Laughing Gull Foundation, but other foundations, other potential founders could support us in continuing this programming after the 3 years are done.
Mm-hmm. And does the Laughing Gull Foundation, do they focus on prison education specifically?
Yes, they do, but they also do LGBTQI and environmental issues. I know that the higher education is in the South region because, as you know, there's more higher education in prison programs in California, in New York, or other regions in the United States. But the South has a history of being particularly difficult, so they are helping the effort in the South to try to have more and more programming across this region.
Dr. Pamela Capistoro, what about other prisons in Florida? Like, how unique is this program?
Well, at least in terms of like the focus of Stetson, right? Like, we are focusing on interdisciplinary liberal arts education. So we are unique in that sense, right? Because I know that there's other programs that have vocational education. I know that at the Exchange for Change in Miami, they provide education, it's creative writing. Mm-hmm. They're not credit bearing yet, but they're working towards that. And I know that UCF recently, I think that they started to launch the prison education program. But I think that Stetson is very unique because what we have at Stetson, what we offer to our Stetson students, that's what we want to offer to the incarcerated students, which is this liberal arts tradition in which students can take, you know, a writing class, they can take a math, they could take a science, right, to have this very, very complete, rigorous education that will help them not only for the future, but this is something that, you know, also helps with family members, right? Because once family members know that they're taking university courses, it has like a domino effect, right? Other mm-hmm. people get excited about it. They have common texts, common topics to talk about. So this is not only benefiting the incarcerated men, but also their family members.
Mm-hmm. What are the differences that you're seeing between the inmates that you're teaching at Tomoka and Stetson University students? Are you seeing some kind of common threads of the way they approach different courses or how they study?
Well, you know, one of the things that it's very interesting with the students at Tomoka is the level of engagement, because they're not young adults, they're adults, right? Like, I think that they're very focused on what they're doing. Actually, we conduct research with our incarcerated students. We have presented at regional, national, and international conferences. So that could be a little bit different from what I do, for example, at Stetson, that it's mm-hmm. a little bit more difficult to conduct research with the undergraduate students over there. And of course, right, like in terms of like the students in Stetson, they're in different stages of their life, right? And our students in Tomoka, they're very committed, and you can have co-researchers and co-instructors over there, because actually I'm teaching a Spanish class right now, and two of the incarcerated men are helping me to co-instruct the course, right? So we are developing teachers at the same time, right? Because this is, for us, it's important that men can see in their own communities that, you know, we can have co-instructors here, right? So I feel that that's a little bit different from what you can see at Stetson mm-hmm. University. And because the space has a lot of limitations, also it has a lot of room for creativity. And one can think that teaching at Stetson can inform what happens in the prison, but I think that it could be also the opposite. Because of the creativity that you have to apply in the prison, a lot of these ideas, you bring them back to Stetson and mm-hmm. improve what you teach at the Stetson campus.
Is there a student at Tomoka who's gone through the course at Tomoka that has really sort of stood out? This story has really struck you as an impressive story, or the way they learned has kind of stayed with you?
I have to say that I think that all the men right now that are involved in the history project are kind of like impressing me a lot, you know, because doing archival research for trying to rearticulate local histories in Florida, it's not easy, right? Mm-hmm. So the project that Dr. Eisen is directing currently, it's about slavery and Indian removal in East Florida. It's very impressive because the men that are doing the project, they have had kind of like found their own passions and then based on their own passions, reflected that on the research. So there's students that are doing research on food, right, that is related to this topic. Some other students are exploring maps of these times and trying to put all this puzzle, historical puzzle together to try to articulate a new narrative about this, history. I think it's very impressive because they also want to provide a public service, right, which is telling new histories about the zone. So I have to say that if I have to pick one student, I will pick them all because I feel that every single student in its own way is a great contributor to what we do in Tomoka.
Well, Dr. Pamela Karpas-Toro is one of the Stetson University faculty members involved in the community education project at Tomoka Maximum Security Men's Prison in Daytona Beach. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, July 4th is a chance to fire up the grill and stock up the smoker. We revisit a conversation with someone who barbecues for a living. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. For many, July 4th is a chance to hit the beach, watch fireworks, and fire up the grill. But it's no holiday for Thomas Ward. He's the proprietor of Pig Floyd's Urban Barbacoa in Orlando. We revisit a conversation with Ward that first aired last year.
So, every morning, Matt comes in at 4:30 in the morning.
Earlier.
Or earlier, yeah. He shows up. We've already placed meat in the smoker starting at 9 at night. So we're cooking brisket and pork overnight. And at 4:30 when he comes in, he places the ribs. They cook for 3 hours on a dry rub. And then we take them out and we wrap them with this rib love. This right here is pork belly. We cook pork belly 3 times a week. Which we use for our pork belly tacos. So we smoke it. This does 700 pounds. It's a Southern Pride. It's really the only way that we could smoke meat without having to tend it 24 hours a day. Because this keeps temperature to the exact degree. And it's easier for us to just place it. And it's just gas assist. So it's very effective and very, you know, sequential and everything it does, so the meat always tastes the same.
And it keeps the ribs and whatever else we've got in there, pork belly, circulating?
Exactly. It keeps it circulating all the time, and basically the fat falls from up top, so it keeps everything fatty, I want to say. After he takes the brisket and the pork out, we place it in an auto sham so that we could keep it in temperature the whole day. And then all this morning preparation right now that's going on is for mainly the tacos. We have 7 different type of tacos, so we got to prep everything. We have also our butter chicken, which is a yogurt marinated chicken that we marinate for 48 hours. We cook it fresh 3 or 4 times a day. You typically don't see tacos in a barbecue joint, and that makes it accessible for a lot of people. We have obviously all our recipes written and documented, but at the same time, I have 2 taste testers that go daily to the restaurant, both restaurants, one of them being my dad. So I get calls if something's off. Like, for example, if he goes over there and he tastes the rice, which we like rice, so if he tastes it, he just basically tells them to throw it away and start over. So it keeps quality going in both restaurants. And you can see it in some of the reviews, you know, that people say it's the same tasting food as in Mills.
Did your dad volunteer for that job?
He did. He did. He likes eating barbecue, and I guess he doesn't get tired of it every day. I get tired of it. I did the menu for 3 months, so after that, I got so tired of barbecue that I gave it a break. And, you know, I have the ribs basically once a week just to make sure that they haven't messed up with the recipe. I definitely try the rice and beans every day because that's the simplest recipe on the in the book, but the most messed up recipe on a daily basis. So that's what I really taste every day, the rice and the beans.
Do all barbecue joints have the same kind of routine, or does everybody do it a little bit different?
I think everybody does it a little bit different. Everybody has different machines. Southern Pride seems to be one of the most popular ones, but everybody has different processes, you know. Most of the Texas barbecue joints, they tend to do it with only wood, so they have to have somebody there tending it all night. You have to be a master at that because everything has a different heat level and everything. So you got to be tending it all the time.
So there's a lot of practice, a lot of art that goes into that?
There is a lot of art that goes into that. So that's originally when I started, you know, I decided to go against that because it's just too hard to be able to maintain it, opening multiple locations and having pit masters working 24 hours a day, because I mean it depends on the volume that you do, but I know Franklin Barbecue in Austin, Texas has people there 24 hours a day and they start smoking at 12 o'clock at night, you know, so somebody has to be there from 12 o'clock till 8 in the morning tending the fire, and then somebody comes in, so it's tough, and they do a lot of volume, a lot more volume than we do. So
people are really into it though, right? I mean, you get lines around the block for that stuff.
They do, yeah. That's amazing. I think he sells now 2,500 pounds of meat a day, which is outrageous. I mean, I wish I had a restaurant that people waited 3 hours every day. I even think people started a business of waiting in line and charging.
So there's this whole economy around barbecue, yeah, in Austin.
Yeah, there is an economy. But he's one of the most popular ones across the United States, you know. So we have a tiny location compared to his. We're 1,600 square feet. So, you know, we try to move people in and out as fast as we can. Obviously, with not being pushy. But it's difficult to be able to maintain what he's doing. And he sells out at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I wish I could do that every day, you know. That'd be great.
So the wood chips is what gives the meat some of the flavor?
Yeah, exactly. We have kiln dry oak wood and pecan, right? So when you place it in the side here of the smoker, place it right here, and basically that fire turns on and heats it up and basically gives it that smoke. We try to use even less logs so that the smoke is not super heavy. But in some of those barbecue joints, I mean, imagine it's all oak or it's all hickory or whatever wood they use. So it's heavy. I mean, it's a heavy smoke, and you're only using wood to keep that fire alive. So it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
There are regional differences to barbecue. Do you think Orlando has a barbecue, or is there a barbecue that is unique to this part of Florida?
Well, that's interesting. I tend to believe, yeah, that regions have their own barbecue. North Carolina has their own barbecue. South Carolina has their own barbecue. Texas has their own barbecue. I mean, here, you got to remember, we have so many people from so many different regions, and we're also very international because we have so many people coming from all over. I don't think there is a Florida barbecue, let's say, per se. I think there is a mashup, you know, our Four Rivers, for example, he does Texas style, right? I don't know what my style is. I would say our style is really, I mean, we're international, so I don't want to be boxed into that.
Maybe that is what Orlando barbecue's about.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I mean, it's really funny because everybody wants different things in the barbecue arena, and barbecue is so traditional, right? So we get people that ask, hey, when are you going to do mac and cheese, you know? Or somebody sent me a message the other day, when are you going to do mashed potatoes? I'm like, I will never do that because that's not my style, right? So some people like the traditional, some people like what's different. But, I mean, I would tell you, no, there's not an exact Florida style, but I think it's all a mashup, you know? And it works because everybody loves barbecue. Everybody loves barbecue. But it's tough when you hear, I talk to a lot of people all the time and they're like, oh yeah, I like to do barbecue at home. But the issue is it takes so long and it's so time heavy that, you know, sometimes it's just easier to get in the car and go eat ribs, you know, somewhere, because they've already done the work for you. It takes so much time. And some people don't understand that we cook daily. So whenever we run out of meat, I can't just go and buy some more meat and just throw it on the grill. You know, it takes 12 hours.
So July 4th, you know, it's summertime, it's a holiday. What's it like for you guys?
It's a really heavy day. That day, actually, we do two smokes just because we have a lot of catering and a lot of people taking out. We do about 80 racks of ribs that day, and we typically sell out by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So it's a really busy day. I like to let everybody leave early so that they could go enjoy it with their family, but sometimes it doesn't work out.
So if you're doing two smokes with this machine, how does that work timing-wise?
So we start the smoke basically at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then at 4 o'clock in the morning we take some of the meat out and we place more meat in, and we take the second batch out at 4 o'clock in the afternoon for all the to-go orders that are later on. So we just want to keep that steady stream and obviously fresh product coming out of the smoker.
Do you find, Thomas, that more people are choosing to go out and just have somebody take care of the food for them?
I think so. I mean, I'm originally from Puerto Rico, so it's a very traditional thing to cook, right? But it's just become so time heavy, right? And for everybody to do it, it takes so long. And obviously, people are now in the time where they just want to get to enjoy the time off they have from work. And, you know, not have to work and slave in the kitchen and then clean up and all that process. So typically everybody that goes to the beach, you know, it's just they don't want to work. They just want to go to the beach, enjoy, and have everything done for them. So I think they should leave the job to us.
You got a padlock on front of your smoker here. Has anybody ever tried to bust this thing open overnight and steal some of the product?
No, we've been pretty lucky. We put it there for security, really. Since this is a little, obviously, open, we didn't want anybody messing with the meat. And we've never had a problem here. It's been super safe. The Mills 50 area is super safe.
So what do you like to eat on July 4th?
I like ribs. Yeah. Ribs is such a traditional traditional meal, and I love ribs. I love our ribs. I love ribs in general. So I eat ribs, and sometimes I like baked beans. So we try to do a recipe that I have for baked beans that's really loaded with sugar. So that's the day where I take the day off from eating healthy and go for it.
Thomas Ward, thank you so much.
Absolutely, thanks.
And that conversation first aired on Intersection last year. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Production assistance for today's show from our intern, Brenda Argueta. Find us on the NPR One app, download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts, and we're online at wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty, and thanks for listening.